They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
The president's budget calls for steep spending cuts and tax increases.
But does it do enough to get the deficit under control?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from our website, marketplace.org. It is Valentine's Day, Monday, February 14th. Hope you're having a great Valentine's Day. Jeremy Hobson.
Thank you. I didn't get the candy hearts you sent, if you sent any, to the New York Bureau. But coming up, a wealthy Arab nation becomes the latest hotspot for anti-government protests. And there's another hurdle on the way for the nation's big booksellers.
But first, the White House unveiled its budget today for the coming fiscal year. It includes more than $1 trillion in cuts. There are some tax hikes in there as well. And already the critics are coming forward. Marketplace's Eve Tro is with us in the studio with more here in Los Angeles. Good morning, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
So this $1+ trillion, where's that coming from?
Well, first off, that's the amount saved over 10 years. It's mostly going to come from budget cuts and, to a lesser extent, tax code changes. The White House wants to freeze all domestic spending that's not related to security issues for 5 years. But that doesn't necessarily mean no new spending. The president is taking what some people call a winners and losers approach. So if you cut subsidies for oil, for example, you can spend that money on new energy research. I talked to Diane Lim Rogers. She's chief economist at the Concord Coalition. She says the White House calls this approach investment, but not everyone agrees.
A lot of these programs are something else. They're assistance programs, so they have public goods benefits, but they aren't necessarily going to grow the economy.
And Republicans say freezing spending at current levels isn't sustainable anyway. They say deeper spending cuts are needed.
All right. So who's going to feel the brunt of the cuts already in this budget?
Well, low-income families, for one. Mm-hmm. A program that helps pay heating bills is on the chopping block, and Pell Grants for higher education. On the other hand, the wealthiest families would lose money, too. The budget reduces their tax deductions for things like charitable donations and mortgage interest.
All right. Marketplace's Eve Tro here in Los Angeles. Eve, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, let's get some analysis now from Julia Coronado. She's chief economist at the investment bank BNP Paribas, and she's with us from here in New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, first of all, Julia, let's just get your reaction to this budget proposal from the White House.
Well, there's a lot of talk about deficit reduction, but there's not a lot of meat on those bones. I mean, to put it in perspective, the proposed budget is $3.7 trillion, and that's up from $2.7 trillion as recently as 2006. So, you know, it's not clear that the government really needs to still be spending as much as it is at this stage of our recovery. And I think another very good indication that deficit reduction isn't a top priority is that there's no discussion of entitlement reform. And really, the growth in spending and Social Security and Medicare is going to be the dominant driver over the next few years.
All right. Well, given that there's no discussion of entitlement reform, how are the bond markets reacting? That seems to be a good nonpartisan way of gauging what they, you know, how serious this budget proposal is.
Right. And I think what they're telling us is, again, there's just not a lot here. Keep in mind that interest rates have risen quite a lot over the last few months. Partly that's because of a stronger economy, which means stronger growth and inflation and higher rates. But part of it is also an increasing skepticism about how quickly the government will bring down the deficit. And so investors want a higher premium to lend money to the federal government. And right now, we're not seeing any reaction. So really, they're not seeing any change in the expected outcome as a result of the proposed budget.
All right. Julia Coronado, chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas. Thanks so much, as always.
My pleasure.
One area of the budget that's a subject of particularly fierce debate is energy innovation spending. That's right. And from the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong has more.
Today's proposal covers next year, even though politicians are still duking out this year's spending. In both cases, the president's push for energy innovation faces cuts. On renewable energy, for instance, House Republicans want to spend 35% less than the White House. Ideologically, the rub is the government's role in bringing early innovations from lab to market. Patrick Clemens is with the American Association for the Advancement of Science.
A lot of these innovations require, you know, a three-year time frame. That's getting on the far edge for industry to start investing in ideas that may or may not come to fruition.
Ideas like advanced batteries, where the government has stepped in and helped U.S. companies take on foreign competition. But that is picking winners, says Nick Loris at the Conservative Heritage Foundation.
The private sector is the one that has the incentive to go out and make the profit and develop the technologies that will be commercially successful because they stand to reap all the economic benefits.
He thinks anything that smacks of applied research will face a tough Republican crowd this Congress. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
You know, Jeremy, a few years back, I was cleaning my parents' garage. And which I think every good son does, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I found what I thought was a collector's item. It was a big beige 8-track tape. Have you seen one of these? You know what an 8-track looks like. You're a young guy.
I know 8-tracks. Sure.
Yeah, it was Supertramp's "Breakfast in America," which was a great band of mine. I just remember Supertramp from many years ago. But I thought about selling this 8-track on eBay.
Yeah.
But what I could have done instead was send it to Bucks Burnett. He's opening this 8-track museum today in Dallas.
Oh.
And I've actually seen that there are YouTube videos of this. This guy has thousands of 8-tracks, all kinds of rare collectibles and things like that, some that have never been opened. They're still, with the shrink wrap on it. Even 8-track players. The 8-track, and I did know this, but it was the first music distribution system made especially for cars. So you could take your music with you. You just plugged it right into the 8-track player in your car. A lot of those 8-track players were aftermarket models. So anyway, so I'm really interested in that, and I'm thinking about this. And today I went to the eBay website, and I found a Supertramp 8-track selling for $1.75. So I'm glad I didn't send it into eBay or try and sell it on eBay, and I probably should have sent it to Bucks. You're listening to the Midday Update for Monday, February 14th. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. Now let's get to the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world. The Egyptian Stock Exchange is still closed, probably not going to open for another 6 or 7 days. And the country's economy continues to reel after weeks of protests against President Hosni Mubarak, who, as you know, resigned on Friday.
Well, today, Jeremy, the British Business Secretary Vince Cable has called for an international effort to track down Mubarak's assets all around the world. The BBC's John Bithrie is with us from London with the latest. Hi, John.
Hello, Steve.
What steps have been taken already on this?
Well, on Friday, the Swiss government ordered its banks to freeze any Mubarak-related assets they held. You mentioned Vince Cable's call there as well. This all does seem to be gathering pace, but it may not be that easy, and it may be hard to prove that those assets were obtained illegally. You'd have to prove in court that Mubarak plundered the Egyptian economy for his own personal gain to get those assets. That may be harder to do than it sounds.
What is Mubarak worth, John?
Well, estimates vary widely. Some believe that his family's wealth could be worth as much as $70 billion, but there are much more modest estimates, including from officials in the US who believe the figure is much lower, something like $2 or $3 billion. Seems to be a mixture of property and company interests we're talking about in Egypt itself, some related to President Mubarak's son Gamal, who had been groomed to take over the presidency. The family also reportedly owned several properties elsewhere in the world, and according to the New York Times, the family also has interests in at least one investment fund based abroad.
All right. The BBC's John Bithrie in London. John, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Well, Egypt's economy is already in shambles after weeks of protests, as you heard. And if that weren't bad enough, Egyptians now have to spend some money to make a democracy. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports it ain't cheap.
Is it right to spend millions of dollars on an election in a poor country desperate for resources?
It's a cost that I think is justified, but it does give one pangs, you know, because you look around and see all the other needs that are unmet.
That's John Stremlaw with the Carter Center. He oversees efforts to promote democracy around the world. He says elections lay the foundation for a stable democracy, and stability paves the way for international donors to make investments.
In Egypt, we're going to go through some uncharted waters because they've not had a credible open election in memory. And so they're going to have to build some of the procedures and institutions, and that will be costly and will take time.
How costly? He says international donors could be looking at election costs in Egypt of about $10 per voter. Comparatively, that's actually a bargain. Stremlaw says elections here in the U.S. cost about $30 per voter. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Well, the unrest continues to spread across the Middle East. There were anti-government protests today in Yemen. In Algeria, reformers have called for a demonstration this coming Saturday. There are reports of protests in Iran. And today, tear gas and rubber bullets were fired on protesters in the Persian Gulf island nation of Bahrain. The difference with Bahrain is that, unlike the others, it is a wealthy Arab country. For more, let's bring in Marketplace's Stephen Beard, who joins us from Amman, Jordan. Good morning, Stephen.
Hello, Jeremy.
So how is the government in Bahrain preparing for this day of protests?
It's been trying to buy off the protesters. The king has decreed that every household in the country is going to get a lump sum of $3,000. He's no doubt hoping that this will blunt the protest and keep the monarchy secure and ensure that he doesn't go the way of Mubarak and the Tunisian president.
Do you think that's going to work?
Well, one political analyst I've been talking to says not. Mohammed Al-Masri of the University of Jordan says this protest in Bahrain is more political than economic. The protesters belong to a different Islamic sect from the ruling elite. They complain they've been discriminated against, excluded from high office and from the top jobs. Al-Masri says they want more democracy.
They are not looking for more cash in their pockets. They want to be partners in the decision-making process.
What happens in Bahrain today, Jeremy, is going to be very interesting because to a greater or lesser extent, regimes throughout the Arab world are trying the same tactic, trying to blunt the protest with cash. We'll get a pretty good indication today whether or not it's going to work.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in Amman, Jordan. Thanks, Stephen.
Okay, Jeremy.
Well, today, a U.S. government panel called the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, it's expected to weigh in on some controversial foreign investment. The Chinese telecom company Huawei wants to take over a California tech company called Three Leaf Systems. Well, Pentagon officials and some members of Congress are concerned the deal poses a national security threat. Marketplace China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz tells us why.
Huawei is run by a former officer of the Chinese military. The fear is that if the company gains a foothold in the U.S. tech market, it'll allow the Chinese government to eavesdrop on classified emails, phone conversations, you name it. David Wolf is a tech consultant in Beijing.
To most of the U.S. lawmakers, what Huawei and companies like it look like is simply an extension of the long arm of the Chinese government, and that makes them uncomfortable.
A Huawei spokesman denies the company has ties to the Chinese government, but a 2008 Pentagon report claims Huawei retains close ties to the Chinese People's Liberation Army. The U.S. isn't the only country that has problems with Huawei. Last week, an EU Commission investigation found Huawei uses an enormous line of credit from China's state-run banks to put itself at an unfair advantage over European companies. As a result, Huawei controls almost the entire wireless modem market in the EU, and it's become the second largest telecom equipment maker in the world. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Monday, Valentine's Day, February 14th. I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles. On Twitter, by the way, if you want to send a Valentine, please. Radio Chio.
And Steve, I still haven't gotten those Valentine candies. If you want to send them, please get them expressed over here.
Right, here we go. Hang on. I'm going online right now.
Oh, good.
Candy. For Jeremy. Okay,
all right. Well, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York on Twitter at Jeremy Hobson, and you can go online and give us feedback anytime, day or night, at marketplace.org. Just click on the link that says contact. Lawyers are wrapping up a conference in Atlanta this morning focused on whether to change the way they're paid because of the changing economy. Right now, attorneys typically bill by the hour, which could explain why lawyers are frequently at the office well into the evening. With a plan on the table would in some cases replace the billable hour with pay based on results. Steve Zack is the president of the American Bar Association, and he joins us now from Atlanta. Good morning.
Good morning.
So getting rid of the billable hour, this has come up before, but is it for real this time?
Well, it's not a matter of getting rid of the hourly bill, because in some instance it makes sense, but it doesn't make sense in all instances, and it's kind of become a holy grail of the profession that needs to be evaluated, and that's what we're doing here. In a lot of instances, really what should be billed for is the value received by the client.
So are the clients in favor of this idea?
Very much. The clients and the lawyers recognize that we have to have a partnership when we represent a client, and their interests and the lawyer's interests have to be one and the same, and that is to efficiently deliver legal services and provide value.
So lawyers aren't worried that this is going to mean less money coming into them?
Well, value building doesn't mean less money. It could mean more money. If, in fact, you have a multi-million dollar lawsuit and you are able to resolve that lawsuit with one phone call, let's say, aren't you happy to pay a value-related result as opposed to having to try the case for several years, pay those fees, and then on top of it have to pay the verdict?
But if you spend a lot of time working on a case that ends up not being such a great case and you've wasted a lot of time on it and don't get paid as much, you would get less money in the pocket.
That's part of it. It's got to be fair on both sides. And if not, there are folks that feel very comfortable that the hourly billing is working well for them, and they're going to continue to use it. So we've got to find a way that lawyers are adequately compensated, but more importantly, that the client feels that they are getting what they're paying for.
Steve Zack, president of the American Bar Association, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you so much.
Borders Books and Music could be filing for bankruptcy as early as today. That's according to the Wall Street Journal. The retailer's troubles come partly from its failure to keep up with technology. And with a new machine that prints and binds e-books, it looks like things could get tougher for the big booksellers. Tracy Samuelson reports.
When you print books for a living, there's one saying that never gets old.
Hot off the press.
That's Dane Neller, CEO of a company called On Demand Books. We're standing in an independent bookstore in New York next to a printer that On Demand has developed. The Espresso Book Machine is a bit bigger than a bathtub. It can print, trim, and bind a book in about the time it takes the cafe here to prepare your espresso.
You can buy in copyright books, public domain books, or if you had your own book, we can make it for you.
McNally Jackson Books recently installed the printer, the first of its kind in New York City, and charges between $10 and $15 for the books it prints. The machine has access to over 4 million titles, including the Google Books catalog. Sarah McNally is the store's owner. She hopes the wider selection will help her compete against big chains and Amazon.
We then become closer and closer to an infinite bookstore.
The printer turns ebook technology on its head, using digital files to print old-school, hard-copy books. Despite all the hype around ebooks, that's what most consumers still want, something they can hold with pages they can flip. Michael Norris is an analyst with Simba Information, a marketing research firm.
There are at least 5 or 6 print book buyers for every 1 ebook buyer.
On Demand will soon begin leasing its printers. Till now, it's sold more than 20 in the U.S. for just under $100,000 apiece, an investment that takes stores around 2 years to recoup. McNally says profit margins on books she prints will be 8 to 16% higher than books off the shelf. Still, the machine is a bit of a financial unknown.
But I think what it does represent is that this bookstore is a bookstore of the future, and it's finding new business models and remaining relevant to its community as the world around it changes.
In other words, innovation has its own value. In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
And finally, Steve, talk about a dangerous job. Firefighters in Germany were called to the middle of a frozen lake to rescue a swan that was trapped in the ice.
Oh.
Now, I know, it's very nice, but yeah. I don't know if I would go out to the middle of a frozen lake
I mean,
but that's what firefighters do.
There.
That's
Come
right.
on.
Well, it was a 25-person rescue operation.
When that's they a got lot out of people.
Absolutely. But the trouble is, when they got out to the middle of the lake, they realized that it was, in fact, a plastic swan that was put there to scare away the birds.
It was a scare swan.
It was a scare swan. On the bright side, one firefighter said, no one was injured, and at least we got a bit of training in. I guess that's one nice way to look at it.
Yes,
well,
it is.
In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And skating on thin ice here in Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chitakis. This is...
You don't have any ice in Los Angeles.
No, it's all water, baby, all water. And happy Valentine's Day, Jeremy.
Happy Valentine's Day.
This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.